would be a considerable effort, and perhaps not worth it after all. So I'm not particularly eager to have you agree to it. What do you say, Second Foundationer? What weapon have you against my mind, which is as strong as yours at least, and against my ships, which are stronger than anything you have ever dreamed of possessing?
What have I? Repeated the first speaker slowly.
Why, nothing, except a little grain. Such a little grain of knowledge that even yet you do not possess. Speak quickly, laughed the mule. Speak inventively, for squirm as you might, you won't squirm out of this.
Poor mutant, said the first speaker. I have nothing to squirm out of.
Ask yourself, why was Bale Channis sent to Calgan as a decoy? Bale Channis, who, though young and brave, is almost as much your mental inferior as is this sleeping officer of yours, this Han Pritcher. Why did I not go, or another of our leaders, who would be more your match?
Perhaps, came the supremely confident reply,
you were not sufficiently foolish, since perhaps none of you are my match.
The true reason is more logical.
You knew Channis to be a Second Foundationer. He lacked the capacity to hide that from you. And you knew, too, that you were his superior, so you were not afraid to play his game and follow him as he wished you to in order to outwit him later.
Had I gone to Calgan, you would have killed me, for I would have been a real danger. Nor had I avoided death by concealing my identity, I would yet have failed in persuading you to follow me into space. It was only known inferiority that lured you on, and had you remained on Calgan, not all the force of the Second Foundation could have harmed you, surrounded as you were by your men, your machines, and your mental power.
My mental power is yet with me, Squirmer, said the mule, and my men and machines are not far off.
Truly so. But you are not on Calgan. You are here in the kingdom of Tazenda, logically presented to you as the Second Foundation, very logically presented. It had to be so presented, for you are a wise man, First Citizen, and would follow only logic.
Correct. And it was a momentary victory for your side. But there was still time for me to worm the truth from your man Channis, and still wisdom in me to realize that such a truth might exist.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.
Correct. And it was a momentary victory for your side. But there was still time for me to worm the truth from your man Channis, and still wisdom in me to realize that such a truth might exist. And on our side, oh, not quite sufficiently subtle one, was the realization that you might go that one step further. And so Bale Channis was prepared for you. That he most certainly was not, for I stripped his brain clean as any plucked chicken. It quivered bare and open before me, and when he said Rossum was the Second Foundation, it was basic truth, for I had ground him so flat and smooth that not the smidgen of a deceit could have found refuge in any microscopic crevice.
True enough. So much the better for our foresight. For I have told you already that Bale Channis was a volunteer. Do you know what sort of a volunteer?
Before he left our foundation for Calgan, and you, he submitted to emotional surgery of a drastic nature. Do you think it was sufficient to deceive you? Do you think Bale Channis, mentally untouched, could possibly deceive you?
No.
Bale Channis was himself deceived, of necessity and voluntarily. Down to the inmost core of his mind, Bale Channis honestly believes that Rossum is the Second Foundation. And for 3 years now, we of the Second Foundation have built up the appearance of that, here in the kingdom of Tazenda, in preparation and waiting for you. And we have succeeded, have we not? You penetrated to Tazenda, and beyond that to Rossum. But past that, you could not go. The mule was upon his feet.
You dare tell me that Rossum also is not the Second Foundation?
Channis, from the floor, felt his bonds burst for good, under a stream of mental force on the part of the first speaker, and strained upright. He let out one long, incredulous cry.
You mean Rossum is not the Second Foundation?
The memories of life, the knowledge of his mind, everything, whirled mistily about him in confusion. The first speaker smiled.
You see, First Citizen, Channis is as upset as you are.
Of course, Rossum is not the Second Foundation. Are we madmen, then, to lead you, our greatest, most powerful,
most dangerous enemy to our world?
Oh, no. Let your fleet bombard Rossem, First Citizen, if you must have it so. Let them destroy all they can. For at most, they can kill only Chanis and myself. And that will leave you in a situation improved, not in the least. For the Second Foundation's expedition to Rossem, which has been here for 3 years and has functioned temporarily as elders in this village, embarked yesterday and are returning to Kalgan. They will evade your fleet, of course, and they will arrive in Kalgan at least a day before you can, which is why I tell you all this. Unless I countermand my orders, when you return, you will find a revolting empire, a disintegrated realm, and only the men with you in your fleet here will be loyal to you. They will be hopelessly outnumbered. And moreover, the men of the Second Foundation will be with your home fleet, and will see to it that you reconvert no one. Your empire is done, mutant. Slowly the mule bowed his head, as anger and despair cornered his mind completely. Yes, too late, too late. Now I see it. Now you see it, agreed the first speaker. And now you don't. In the despair of that moment, when the mule's mind lay open, the first speaker, ready for that moment and pre-sure of its nature, entered quickly. It required a rather insignificant fraction of a second to consummate the change completely. The mule looked up and said, "Then I shall return to Kalgan?" "Certainly. How do you feel?" "Excellently well." His brow puckered. "Who are you?" "Does it matter?" "Of course not." He dismissed the matter and touched Pritchard's shoulder. "Wake up, Pritchard. We're going home." It was 2 hours later that Bale Chanis felt strong enough to walk by himself. He said, "Won't he ever remember?" "Never. He retains his mental powers and his empire, but his motivations are now entirely different. The notion of a Second Foundation is a blank to him, and he is a man of peace. He will be a far happier man henceforward, too, for the few years of life left him by his maladjusted physique. And then, after he is dead, Selden's plan will go on, somehow." "And it is true," urged Chanis. "It is true that Rossem is not the Second Foundation? I could swear, I tell you, I know it is. I am not mad." "You are not mad, Chanis. Merely, as I have said, changed. Rossem is not the Second Foundation. Come, we too will return home." Last interlude. Bale Chanis sat in the small white-tiled room and allowed his mind to relax. He was content to live in the present. There were the walls and the window and the grass outside. They had no names. They were just things. There was a bed and a chair, and books that developed themselves idly on the screen at the foot of his bed. There was the nurse who brought him his food. At first he had made efforts to piece together the scraps of things he had heard, such as those two men talking together. One had said, "Complete aphasia now. It's cleaned out, and I think without damage. It will only be necessary to return the recording of his original brainwave makeup." He remembered the sounds by rote, and for some reason they seemed peculiar sounds, as if they meant something. But why bother? Better to watch the pretty changing colors on the screen at the foot of the thing he lay on. And then someone entered and did things to him, and for a long time he slept. And when that had passed, the bed was suddenly a bed, and he knew he was in a hospital, and the words he remembered made sense. He sat up. "What's happening?" The first speaker was beside him. "You're on the Second Foundation, and you have your mind back. Your original mind." "Yes. Yes!" Chanis came to the realization that he was himself, and there was incredible triumph and joy in that. "And now tell me," said the first speaker, "do you know where the Second Foundation is now?" And the truth came flooding down in one enormous wave, and Chanis did not answer. Like Ebling Miz before him, he was conscious of only one vast, numbing surprise, until he finally nodded and said, "By the stars of the galaxy, now I know!" Part 2. Search by the Foundation. Chapter 7. Arcadia. Daryl Arcady, novelist, born 11-5-362 F.E., died 1-7-443 FE, Although primarily a writer of fiction, Arkady Darrell is best known for her biography of her grandmother, Beta Darrell. Based on first-hand information, it has for centuries served as a primary source of information concerning the mule and his times. Like Unkeyed Memories, her novel Time and Time and Over is a stirring reflection of the brilliant Kalganian society of the early interregnum, based, it is said, on a visit to Kalgan in her youth. Encyclopedia Galactica. Arkadia Darrell declaimed firmly into the mouthpiece of her transcriber, The Future of Selden's Plan, by A. Darrell, and then thought darkly that someday, when she was a great writer, she would write all her masterpieces under the pseudonym of Arkady. Just Arkady, no last name at all. A. Darrell would be just the sort of thing that she would have to put on all her themes for her class in composition and rhetoric. So tasteless. All the other kids had to do it, too, except for Olynthus Dam, because the class laughed so when he did it the first time. And Arkadia was a little girl's name, wished on her because her great-grandmother had been called that. Her parents just had no imagination at all. Now that she was 2 days past 14, you'd think they'd recognize the simple fact of adulthood and call her Arkady. Her lips tightened as she thought of her father looking up from his book viewer just long enough to say, But if you're going to pretend you're 19, Arkadia, what will you do when you're 25 and all the boys think you're 30? From where she sprawled across the arms and into the hollow of her own special armchair, she could see the mirror on her dresser. Her foot was a little in the way because her house slipper kept twirling about her big toe. So she pulled it in and sat up with an unnatural straightness to her neck that she felt sure, somehow, lengthened it a full 2 inches into slim regality. For a moment, she considered her face thoughtfully. Too fat. She opened her jaws half an inch behind closed lips and caught the resultant trace of unnatural gauntness at every angle. She licked her lips with a quick touch of tongue and let them pout a bit in moist softness. Then she let her eyelids droop in a weary, worldly way. Oh, golly, if only her cheeks weren't that silly pink! She tried putting her fingers to the outer corners of her eye and tilting the lids a bit to get that mysterious, exotic languor of the women of the inner star systems. But her hands were in the way, and she couldn't see her face very well. Then she lifted her chin, caught herself at half profile, and with her eyes a little strained from looking out the corner and her neck muscles faintly aching, she said in a voice one octave below its natural pitch, Really, Father, if you think it makes a particle of difference to me what some silly old boys think, you just... And then she remembered that she still had the transmitter open in her hand and said drearily, Oh, golly, and shut it off. The faintly violet paper with the peach margin line on the left had upon it the following. The Future of Selden's Plan. Really, Father, if you think it makes a particle of difference to me what some silly old boys think, you just... Oh, golly. She pulled the sheet out of the machine with annoyance, and another clicked neatly into place. But her face smoothed out of its vexation nevertheless, and her wide little mouth stretched into a self-satisfied smile. She sniffed at the paper delicately. Just right. Just that proper touch of elegance and charm. And the penmanship was just the last word. The machine had been delivered 2 days ago on her first adult birthday. She had said, But Father, everybody, just everybody in the class who has the slightest pretensions to being anybody has one. Nobody but some old drips would use hand machines. The salesman had said, There is no other model as compact on the one hand and as adaptable on the other. It will spell and punctuate correctly according to the sense of the sentence. Naturally, it is a great aid to education, since it encourages the user to employ careful enunciation and breathing in order to make sure of the correct spelling, to say nothing of demanding a proper and elegant delivery for correct punctuation. Even then, her father had tried to get one geared for type print, as if she were some dried-up old maid teacher. But when it was delivered, it was the model she wanted. Obtained, perhaps, with a little more wail and sniffle than quite went with the adulthood of 14, and copy was turned out in a charming and entirely feminine handwriting, with the most beautifully graceful capitals anyone ever saw. Even the phrase, Oh golly, somehow breathed glamour when the transcriber was done with it. But just the same, she had to get it right, so she sat up straight in her chair, placed her first draft before her in businesslike fashion, and began again, crisply and clearly. Her abdomen flat, her chest lifted, and her breathing carefully controlled. She intoned, with dramatic fervor, The Future of Selden's Plan. The Foundation's past history is, I am sure, well known to all of us who have had the good fortune to be educated in our planet's efficient and well-staffed school system. There, that would start things off right with Miss Erlking, that mean old hag. That past history is largely the past history of the great plan of Harry Selden. The two are one. But the question in the mind of most people today is whether this plan will continue in all its great wisdom, or whether it will be foully destroyed, or, perhaps, has been so destroyed already. To understand this, it may be best to pass quickly over some of the highlights of the plan as it has been revealed to humanity thus far. This part was easy, because she had taken modern history the semester before. In the days, nearly four centuries ago, when the first galactic empire was decaying into the paralysis that preceded final death, one man, the great Harry Selden, foresaw the approaching end. Through the science of psychohistory, the intricacies of whose mathematics has long since been forgotten, she paused in a trifle of doubt. She was sure that intricacies was pronounced with soft C's, but the spelling didn't look right. Oh well, the machine couldn't very well be wrong. He and the men who worked with him are able to foretell the course of the great social and economic currents sweeping the galaxy at the time. It was possible for them to realize that, left to itself, the empire would break up, and that thereafter there would be at least 30,000 years of anarchic chaos prior to the establishment of a new empire. It was too late to prevent the great fall, but it was still possible, at least, to cut short the intermediate period of chaos. The plan was, therefore, evolved whereby only a single millennium would separate the Second Empire from the First. We are completing the fourth century of that millennium, and many generations of men have lived and died, while the plan has continued its inexorable workings. Harry Selden established two foundations at the opposite ends of the galaxy, in a manner and under such circumstances as would yield the best mathematical solution for his psychohistorical problem. In one of these, our foundation, established here on Terminus, there was concentrated the physical science of the empire, and through the possession of that science, the foundation was able to withstand the attacks of the barbarous kingdoms which had broken away and become independent, out at the fringe of the empire. The foundation, indeed, was able to conquer in its turn these short-lived kingdoms by means of the leadership of a series of wise and heroic men, like Salvor Hardin and Hober Mallow, who were able to interpret the plan intelligently and to guide our land through its... She had written intricacies here also, but decided not to risk it a second time. Complications. All our planets still revere their memories, although centuries have passed. Eventually, the Foundation established a commercial system which controlled a large portion of the Siwenian and Anacreonian sectors of the galaxy, and even defeated the remnants of the old empire under its last great general, Belrios. It seemed that nothing could now stop the workings of Selden's plan. Every crisis that Selden had planned had come at its appropriate time, and had been solved. And with each solution, the Foundation had taken another giant stride towards Second Empire and peace. And then, her breath came short at this point, and she hissed the words between her teeth, but the transmitter simply wrote them, calmly and gracefully. With the last remnants of the dead First Empire gone, and with only ineffectual warlords ruling over the splinters and remnants of the decayed Colossus. She got that phrase out of a thriller on the video last week, but old Miss Erlking never listened to anything but symphonies and lectures, so she'd never know. There came the mule. This strange man was not allowed for in the plan. He was a mutant, whose birth could not have been predicted. He had the strange and mysterious power of controlling and manipulating human emotions, and in this manner could bend all men to his will. With breathtaking swiftness, he became a conqueror and empire builder, until finally, he even defeated the Foundation itself. Yet he never obtained universal dominion, since in his first overpowering lunge, he was stopped by the wisdom and daring of a great woman. Now there was that old problem again. Father would insist that she never bring up the fact that she was the grandchild of Beta Darrell. Everyone knew it, and Beta was just about the greatest woman there ever was, and she had stopped the mule single-handed. In a manner, the true story of which is known in its entirety to very few. There, if she had to read it to the class, that last could be said in a dark voice, and someone would be sure to ask what the true story was, and then, Well, and then she couldn't help tell the truth if they asked her, could she? In her mind, she was already wordlessly whizzing through a hurt and eloquent explanation to a stern and questioning paternal parent. After 5 years of restricted rule, another change took place, the reasons for which are not known, and the mule abandoned all plans for further conquest. His last 5 years were those of an enlightened despot. It is said by some that the change in the mule was brought about by the intervention of the Second Foundation. However, no man has ever discovered the exact location of this other foundation, nor knows its exact function, so that theory remains unproven. A whole generation has passed since the death of the mule. What of the future, then, now that he has come and gone? He interrupted Selden's plan, and seemed to have burst it to fragments. Yet as soon as he died, the foundation rose again, like a nova from the dead ashes of a dying star. She had made that up herself. Once again, the planet Terminus houses the center of a commercial federation, almost as great and as rich as before the conquest, and even more peaceful and democratic. Is this planned? Is Selden's great dream still alive? And will a second galactic empire yet be formed 600 years from now? I, myself, believe so. Because, this was the important part, Miss Earle King always had those large, ugly red pencil scrawls that went, "But this is only descriptive. What are your personal reactions? Think, express yourself, penetrate your own soul." Penetrate your own soul. A lot she knew about souls, with her lemon face that never smiled in its life. Never at any time has the political situation been so favorable. The old empire is completely dead, and the period of the mule's rule put an end to the era of warlords that preceded him. Most of the surrounding portions of the galaxy are civilized and peaceful. Moreover, the internal health of the Foundation is better than ever before. The despotic times of the pre-conquest hereditary mayors have given way to the democratic elections of early times. There are no longer dissident worlds of independent traders, no longer the injustices and dislocations that accompanied accumulations of great wealth in the hands of a few. There is no reason, therefore, to fear failure, unless it is true that the Second Foundation itself presents a danger. Those who think so have no evidence to back their claim, but merely vague fears and superstitions. I think that our confidence in ourselves, in our nation, and in Harry Selden's great plan should drive from our hearts and minds all uncertainties and... this was awfully corny, but something like this was expected at the end. So I say, that is as far as the future of Selden's plan got at that moment, because there was the gentlest little tap on the window, and when Arcadia shot up to balance on one arm of the chair, she found herself confronted by a smiling face beyond the glass, its even symmetry of feature interestingly accentuated by the short, vertical line of a finger before its lips. With the slight pause necessary to assume an attitude of bepuzzlement, Arcadia dismounted from the armchair, walked to the couch that fronted the wide window that held the apparition, and kneeling upon it, stared out thoughtfully. The smile upon the man's face faded quickly. While the fingers of one hand tightened whitely upon the sill, the other made a quick gesture. Arcadia obeyed calmly, and closed the latch that moved the lower third of the window smoothly into its socket in the wall, allowing the warm spring air to interfere with the conditioning within. "You can't get in," she said with comfortable smugness. "The windows are all screened, and keyed only to people who belong here. If you come in, all sorts of alarms will break loose." A pause. Then she added, "You look sort of silly balancing on that ledge underneath the window. If you're not careful, you'll fall and break your neck and a lot of valuable flowers." "In that case," said the man at the window, who had been thinking that very thing, with a slightly different arrangement of adjectives, "will you shut off the screen and let me in?" "No use in doing that," said Arcadia. "You're probably thinking of a different house, because I'm not the kind of girl who lets strange men into her bedroom this time of night." Her eyes, as she said it, took on a heavy-lidded sultriness, or an unreasonable facsimile thereof. All traces of humor whatever had disappeared from the young stranger's face. He muttered, "This is Dr. Darrell's house, isn't it? Why should I tell you?" "Oh, Galaxy, goodbye. If you jump off, young man, I will personally give the alarm." This was intended as a refined and sophisticated thrust of irony. since to Arcadia's enlightened eyes, the intruder was an obviously mature 30 at least. Quite elderly, in fact. Quite a pause. Then, tightly, he said, "Well, now, look here, girlie. If you don't want me to stay, and don't want me to go, what do you want me to do? You can come in, I suppose. Dr. Darrell does live here. I'll shut off the screen now." Warily, after a searching look, the young man poked his head through the window, then hunched himself up and through it. He brushed at his knees with an angry, slapping gesture, and lifted a reddened face at her. "You're quite sure that your character and reputation won't suffer when they find me here, are you? Not as much as yours would, because just as soon as I hear footsteps outside, I'll just shout and yell and say you forced your way in here." "Yes," he replied with heavy courtesy. "And how do you intend to explain the shut-off protective screen?" "Poof, that would be easy. There wasn't any there in the first place." The man's eyes were wide with chagrin. "That was a bluff?" "How old are you, kid?" "I consider that a very impertinent question, young man, and I am not accustomed to being addressed as kid."
"I don't wonder. You're probably the mule's grandmother in disguise. Do you mind if I leave now before you arrange a lynching party with myself as star performer?" "You'd better not leave, because my father's expecting you." The man's look became a wary one again. An eyebrow shot up as he said lightly, "Oh? Anyone with your father?" "No." "Anyone called on him lately?" "Only tradespeople. And you?" "Anything unusual happen at all?" "Only you. Forget me, will you?" "No, don't forget me. Tell me, how did you know your father was expecting me?" "Oh, that was easy. Last week he received a personal capsule, keyed to him personally with a self-oxidizing message, you know? He threw the capsule shell into the trash Jacinto, and yesterday he gave Polly, that's our major, see, a month's vacation so she could visit her sister in Terminus City. And this afternoon he made up the bed in the spare room, so I knew he expected somebody that I wasn't supposed to know anything about. Usually he tells me everything. Really, I'm surprised he has to. I should think you'd know everything before he tells you." "I usually do." Then she laughed. She was beginning to feel very much at ease. The visitor was elderly, but very distinguished-looking, with curly brown hair and very blue eyes. Maybe she could meet somebody like that again, sometimes, when she was old herself. "And just how?" he asked. "Did you know it was I he expected?" "Well, who else could it be? He was expecting somebody in so secrety a way, if you know what I mean. And then you came gumping around trying to sneak through windows instead of walking through the front door, the way you would if you had any sense." She remembered a favorite line and used it promptly. "Men are so stupid." "Pretty stuck on yourself, aren't you, kid? I mean, miss. You could be wrong, you know. What if I told you that all this is a mystery to me, and that as far as I know, your father is expecting someone else, not me?" "Oh, I don't think so. I didn't ask you to come in until after I saw you drop your briefcase." "My what?" "Your briefcase, young man. I'm not blind. You didn't drop it by accident because you looked down first, so as to make sure it would land right. Then you must have realized it would land just under the hedges and wouldn't be seen, so you dropped it and didn't look down afterwards. Now, since you came to the window instead of the front door, it must mean that you were a little afraid to trust yourself in the house before investigating the place. And after you had a little trouble with me, you took care of your briefcase before taking care of yourself, which means that you consider whatever your briefcase has in it to be more valuable than your own safety. And that means that as long as you're in here and the briefcase is out there, and we know that it's out there, you're probably pretty helpless." She paused for a much-needed breath. And the man said, grittily, "Except that I think I'll choke you just about medium dead and get out of here with the briefcase. Except, young man, that I happen to have a baseball bat under my bed, which I can reach in 2 seconds from where I'm sitting, and I'm very strong for a girl." Impasse. Finally, with a strained courtesy, the young man said, "Shall I introduce myself since we're being so chummy? I'm Peleus Anthor. And your name?" "I'm Arcady Darrell, pleased to meet you. And now, Arcady, would you be a good little girl and call your father?" Arcadia bridled. "I'm not a little girl. I think you're very rude, especially when you're asking a favor." Peleus Anthor sighed. "Very well.
Would you be a good, kind, dear little old lady just chock full of lavender and call your father? That's not what I meant either, but I'll call him. Only not so I'll take my eyes off you, young man. And she stamped on the floor. There came the sound of hurrying footsteps in the hall, and the door was flung open. Arcadia! There was a tiny explosion of exhaled air, and Dr. Darrell said, "Who are you, sir?" Pelias sprang to his feet in what was quite obviously relief. "Dr. Torrin Darrell, I'm Pelias Anther. You've received word about me, I think. At least your daughter says you have." "My daughter says I have?" He bent a frowning glance at her, which caromed harmlessly off the wide-eyed and impenetrable web of innocence with which she met the accusation. Dr. Darrell said finally, "I have been expecting you. Would you mind coming down with me, please?" And he stopped as his eye caught a flicker of motion, which Arcadia caught simultaneously. She scrambled towards her transcriber, but it was quite useless, since her father was standing right next to it. He said sweetly, "You've left it going all this time, Arcadia."
"Father,"
she squeaked in real anguish,
"it is very ungentlemanly to read another person's private correspondence, especially when it's talking correspondence."
"Ah," said her father, "but talking correspondence with a strange man in your bedroom. As a father, Arcadia, I must protect you against evil."
"Oh, golly, it was nothing like that."
Pelias laughed suddenly. "Oh, but it was, Dr. Darrell. The young lady was going to accuse me of all sorts of things, and I must insist that you read it, if only to clear my name."
"Oh."
Arcadia held back her tears with an effort. Her own father didn't even trust her. And that darn transcriber, if that silly fool hadn't come gooping at the window and making her forget to turn it off, and now her father would be making long, gentle speeches about what young ladies aren't supposed to do. There just wasn't anything they were supposed to do, it looked like, except choke and die, maybe. This book is continued on cassette number 4. And now her father would be making long, gentle speeches about what young ladies aren't supposed to do. There just wasn't anything they were supposed to do, it looked like, except choke and die, maybe. "Arcadia," said her father gently, "it strikes me that a young lady, she knew it, should not be quite so impertinent to men older than she is." "Well, what did he want to come peeping around my window for? A young lady has a right to privacy. Now I'll have to do my whole darn composition over." "It's not up to you to question his propriety in coming to your window. You should simply not have let him in. You should have called me instantly, especially if you thought I was expecting him." She said peevishly, "It's just as well if you didn't see him, stupid thing. He'll give the whole thing away if he keeps going to windows instead of doors." "Arcadia, nobody wants your opinion on matters you know nothing of." "I do, too. It's a second foundation, that's what it is." There was a silence. Even Arcadia felt a little nervous stirring in her abdomen. Dr. Darrell said softly, "Where have you heard this?" "Nowheres. But what else is there to be so secret about? You don't have to worry that I'll tell anyone." "Mr. Anthor," said Dr. Darrell, "I must apologize for all this." "Oh, that's all right," came Anthor's rather hollow response. "It's not your fault if she sold herself to the forces of darkness. But do you mind if I ask her a question before we go? Miss Arcadia, what do you want? Why do you think it is stupid to go to windows instead of to doors?" "Because you advertise what you're trying to hide, silly. If I have a secret, I don't put tape over my mouth and let everyone know I have a secret. I talk just as much as usual, only about something else. Didn't you ever read any of the sayings of Salvor Hardin? He was our first mayor, you know." "Yes, I know." "Well, he used to say that only a lie that wasn't ashamed of itself could possibly succeed. He also said that nothing had to be true, but everything had to sound true. Well, when you come in through a window, it's a lie that's ashamed of itself and doesn't sound true." "Then what would you have done?" "If I had wanted to see my father on top-secret business, I would have made his acquaintance openly and seen him about all sorts of strictly legitimate things. And then when everyone else knew all about you and connected you with my father as a matter of course, you could be as top-secret as you want, and nobody would ever think of questioning it." Anthor looked at the girl strangely, then at Dr. Darrell. He said, "Let's go.
I have a briefcase I want to pick up in the garden. Wait. Just one last question. Arcadia, you don't really have a baseball bat under your bed, do you? No, I don't. Ha! I didn't think so. Dr. Darrell stopped at the door. Arcadia, he said, when you rewrite your composition on the Selden plan, don't be unnecessarily mysterious about your grandmother. There is no necessity to mention that part at all. He and Peleus descended the stairs in silence. Then the visitor asked in a strained voice, "Do you mind, sir? How old is she?" 14, day before yesterday. 14? Great galaxy. Tell me, has she ever said she expects to marry someday? No, she hasn't. Not to me. Well, if she ever does, shoot him. The one she's going to marry, I mean. He stared earnestly into the older man's eyes. I'm serious. Life could hold no greater horror than living with what she'll be like when she's 20. I don't mean to offend you, of course. You don't offend me. I think I know what you mean. Upstairs, the object of their tender analyses faced the transcriber with revolted weariness and said dully, "The future of Selden's plan." The transcriber, with infinite aplomb, translated that into elegantly complicated script capitals as, "The future of Selden's plan." Chapter 8. Selden's Plan. Mathematics. The synthesis of the calculus of n variables and of n-dimensional geometry is the basis of what Selden once called my little algebra of humanity. Encyclopedia Galactica. Consider a room. The location of the room is not in question at the moment. It is merely sufficient to say that in that room, more than anywhere, the second foundation existed. It was a room which, through the centuries, had been the abode of pure science, yet it had none of the gadgets with which, through millennia of association, science has come to be considered equivalent. It was a science, instead, which dealt with mathematical concepts only, in a manner similar to the speculation of ancient races in the primitive prehistoric days, before technology had come to be, before man had spread beyond a single, now unknown world. For one thing, there was in that room, protected by a mental science as yet unassailable by the combined physical might of the rest of the galaxy, the prime radiant, which held in its vitals the Selden plan, complete. For another, there was a man, too, in that room, the first speaker. He was the 12th in line of the chief guardians of the plan, and his title bore no deeper significance than the fact that at the gatherings of the leaders of the Second Foundation, he spoke first. His predecessor had beaten the mule, but the wreckage of that gigantic struggle still littered the path of the plan. For 25 years, he and his administration had been trying to force a galaxy of stubborn and stupid human beings back to the path. It was a terrible task. The first speaker looked up at the opening door, even while, in the loneliness of the room, he considered his quarter century of effort, which now so slowly and inevitably approached its climax. Even while he had been so engaged, his mind had been considering the newcomer with a gentle expectation. A youth, a student, one of those who might take over, eventually. The young man stood uncertainly at the door, so that the first speaker had to walk to him and lead him in, with a friendly hand upon the shoulder. The student smiled shyly, and the first speaker responded by saying, "First, I must tell you why you are here." They faced each other now, across the desk. Neither was speaking in any way that could be recognized as such by any man in the galaxy who was not himself a member of the Second Foundation. Speech, originally, was the device whereby man learned, imperfectly, to transmit the thoughts and emotions of his mind. By setting up arbitrary sounds and combinations of sounds to represent certain mental nuances, he developed a method of communication, but one which in its clumsiness and thick-thumbed inadequacy degenerated all the delicacy of the mind into gross and guttural signaling. Down, down, the results can be followed, and all the suffering that humanity ever knew can be traced to the one fact that no man in the history of the galaxy, until Harry Selden, and very few men thereafter, could really understand one another, Every human being lived behind an impenetrable wall of choking mist, within which no other but he existed. Occasionally, there were dim signals from deep within the cavern in which another man was located, so that each might grope toward the other. Yet because they did not know one another, and could not understand one another, and dared not trust one another, and felt from infancy the terrors and insecurity of that ultimate isolation, there was the hunted fear of man for man, the savage rapacity of man toward man. Feet, for tens of thousands of years, had clogged and shuffled in the mud, and held down the minds which, for an equal time, had been fit for the companionship of the stars. Grimly, man had instinctively sought to circumvent the prison bars of ordinary speech. Semantics, symbolic logic, psychoanalysis, they had all been devices whereby speech could either be refined or bypassed. Psychohistory had been the development of mental science, the final mathematicization thereof, rather, which had finally succeeded. Through the development of the mathematics necessary to understand the facts of neural physiology and the electrochemistry of the nervous system, which themselves had to be, traced down to nuclear forces, it first became possible to truly develop psychology, and through the generalization of psychological knowledge from the individual to the group, sociology was also mathematicized. The larger groups, the billions that occupied planets, the trillions that occupied sectors, the quadrillions that occupied the whole galaxy, became not simply human beings, but gigantic forces amenable to statistical treatment. So that to Harry Seldon, the future became clear and inevitable, and the plan could be set up. The same basic developments of mental science that had brought about the development of the Seldon plan thus made it also unnecessary for the first speaker to use words in addressing the student. Every reaction to a stimulus, however slight, was completely indicative of all the trifling changes, of all the flickering currents that went on in another's mind. The first speaker could not sense the emotional content of the students instinctively, as the mule would have been able to do, since the mule was a mutant with powers not ever likely to become completely comprehensible to any ordinary man, even a second foundationer. Rather, he deduced them as the result of intensive training. Since, however, it is inherently impossible in a society based on speech to indicate truly the method of communication of second foundationers among themselves, the whole matter will be hereafter ignored. The first speaker will be represented as speaking in ordinary fashion, and if the translation is not always entirely valid, it is at least the best that can be done under the circumstances. It will be pretended, therefore, that the first speaker did actually say, "First, I must tell you why you are here," instead of smiling, just so, and lifting a finger, exactly thus. The first speaker said, "You have studied mental science hard and well for most of your life. You have absorbed all your teachers could give you. It is time for you and a few others like yourself to begin your apprenticeship for speakerhood." Agitation from the other side of the desk. "No, now you must take this phlegmatically. You had hoped you would qualify. You had feared you would not. Actually, both hope and fear are weaknesses. You knew you would qualify, and you hesitate to admit the fact because such knowledge might stamp you as cocksure and therefore unfit. Nonsense. The most hopelessly stupid man is he who is not aware that he is wise. It is part of your qualification that you knew you would qualify." Relaxation on the other side of the desk. "Exactly. Now you feel better and your guard is down. You are fitter to concentrate and fitter to understand. Remember, to be truly effective, it is not necessary to hold the mind under a tight controlling barrier, which to the intelligent probe is as informative as a naked mentality. Rather, one should cultivate an innocence, an awareness of self, and an unself-consciousness of self, which leaves one nothing to hide. My mind is open to you. Let this be so for both of us." He went on. "It is not an easy thing to be a speaker. It is not an easy thing to be a psychohistorian in the first place. And not even the best psychohistorian need necessarily qualify to be a speaker. There is a distinction here. A speaker must not only be aware of the mathematical intricacies of the Seldon plan, He must have a sympathy for it and for its ends. He must love the plan. To him it must be life and breath. More than that, it must even be as a living friend. Do you know what this is? The first speaker's hand hovered gently over the black shining cube in the middle of the desk. It was featureless. No, speaker, I do not. You have heard of the Prime Radiant? This? Astonishment. You expected something more noble and awe-inspiring? Well, that is natural. It was created in the days of the Empire by men of Selden's time. For nearly 400 years, it has served our needs perfectly, without requiring repairs or adjustment. And fortunately so, since none of the Second Foundation is qualified to handle it in any technical fashion. He smiled gently. Those of the First Foundation might be able to duplicate this, but they must never know, of course. He depressed a lever on his side of the desk, and the room was in darkness. But only for a moment, since with a gradually livening flush, the two long walls of the room glowed to life. First a pearly white, unrelieved, then a trace of faint darkness here and there, and finally the fine, neatly printed equations in black, with an occasional red hairline that wavered through the darker forest like a staggering rillet. Come, my boy, step here before the wall. You will not cast a shadow. If this light does not radiate from the radiant in an ordinary manner. To tell you the truth, I do not know even faintly by what medium this effect is produced. But you will not cast a shadow. I know that. They stood together in the light. Each wall was 30 feet long and 10 high. The writing was small and covered every inch. This is not the whole plan, said the first speaker. To get it all upon both walls, the individual equations would have to be reduced to microscopic size. But that is not necessary. What you see here represents the main portions of the plan till now. You have learned about these, have you not? Yes, Speaker, I have. Do you recognize any portion? A slow silence. The student pointed a finger, and as he did so, the line of equations marched down the wall, until the single series of functions he had thought of. One could scarcely consider the quick, generalized gesture of the finger to have been sufficiently precise, was at eye level. The first speaker laughed softly. You will find the Prime Radiant to be attuned to your mind. You may expect more surprises from the little gadget. What were you about to say about the equation you have chosen? It, faltered the student, is a Rigelian integral, using a planetary distribution of a bias indicating the presence of two chief economic classes on the planet, or maybe a sector, plus an unstable emotional pattern. And what does it signify? It represents the limit of tension, since we have here, he pointed, and again the equations veered, a converging series. Good, said the first speaker. And tell me, what do you think of all this? A finished work of art, is it not? Definitely. Wrong. It is not. This with sharpness. It is the first lesson you must unlearn. The Selden plan is neither complete nor correct. Instead, it is merely the best that could be done at the time. Over a dozen generations of men have pored over these equations, worked at them, taken them apart to the last decimal place and put them back together again. They've done more than that. They've watched nearly 400 years pass, and against the predictions and equations they've checked reality, and they have learned. They have learned more than Selden ever knew. And if with the accumulated knowledge of the centuries we could repeat Selden's work, we could do a better job. Is that perfectly clear to you? The student appeared a little shocked. Before you obtain your speakerhood, continued the first speaker, you yourself will have to make an original contribution to the plan. It is not such great blasphemy. Every red mark you see on the wall is the contribution of a man among us who lived since Selden. Why, he looked upward. There. The whole wall seemed to whirl down upon him. This, he said, is mine. A fine red line encircled two forking arrows and included 6 square feet of deductions along each path. Between the two were a series of equations in red. It does not, said the speaker, seem to be much. It is at a point in the plan which we will not reach yet for a time as long as that which has already passed. It is at the period of coalescence, when the second empire that is to be is in the grip of rival personalities who will threaten to pull it apart if the fight is too even, or clamp it into rigidity if the fight is too uneven. Both possibilities are considered here, followed, and the method of avoiding either indicated. Yet it is all a matter of probabilities, and a third course can exist. It is one of comparatively low likelihood, 12.64% to be exact. But even smaller chances have already come to pass, and the plan is only 40% complete. This third probability consists of a possible compromise between two or more of the conflicting personalities being considered. This, I showed, would freeze first the Second Empire into an unprofitable mold, and then eventually inflict more damage through civil wars than would have taken place had a compromise never been made in the first place. Fortunately, that could be prevented too. Then that was my contribution. If I may interrupt, Speaker, how is a change made? Through the agency of the Radiant. You will find in your own case, for instance, that your mathematics will be checked rigorously by 5 different boards, and that you will be required to defend it against a concerted and merciless attack. 2 years will then pass, and your development will be reviewed again. It has happened more than once that a seemingly perfect piece of work has uncovered its fallacies, only after an induction period of months or years. Sometimes the contributor himself discovers the flaw. If, after 2 years, another examination, not less detailed than the first, still passes it, and better still, if in the interim the young scientist has brought to light additional details, subsidiary evidence, the contribution will be added to the plan. It was the climax of my career. It will be the climax of yours. The prime radiant can be adjusted to your mind, and all corrections and additions can be made through mental rapport. There will be nothing to indicate that the correction or addition is yours. In all the history of the plan, there has been no personalization. It is rather a creation of all of us together. Do you understand? Yes, Speaker. Then enough of that. Astride to the prime radiant, and the walls were blank again, save for the ordinary room lighting region along the upper borders. Sit down here at my desk and let me talk to you. It is enough for a psychohistorian, as such, to know his biostatistics and his neurochemical electromathematics. Some know nothing else and are fit only to be statistical technicians. But a speaker must be able to discuss the plan without mathematics, if not the plan itself, at least its philosophy and its aims. First of all, what is the aim of the plan? Please tell me in your own words, and don't grope for fine sentiment. You won't be judged on polish and suavity, I assure you. It was the student's first chance at more than a bisyllable, and he hesitated before plunging into the expectant space cleared away for him. He said diffidently, "As a result of what I have learned, I believe that it is the intention of the plan to establish a human civilization based on an orientation entirely different from anything that ever existed before. An orientation which, according to the findings of psychohistory, could never spontaneously come into being." "Stop!" The first speaker was insistent. "You must not say never. That is a lazy slurring over of the facts. Actually, psychohistory predicts only probabilities. A particular event may be infinitesimally probable, but the probability is always greater than zero." "Yes, Speaker." "The orientation desired, if I may correct myself, then, is well known to possess no significant probability of spontaneously coming to pass." "Better. What is the orientation?" "It is that of a civilization based on mental science. In all the known history of mankind, advances have been made primarily in physical technology, in the capacity of handling the inanimate world about man. Control of self and society has been left to chance, or to the vague gropings of intuitive ethical systems based on inspiration and emotion. As a result, no culture of greater stability than of about 55% has ever existed, and these only as the result of great human misery. And why is the orientation we speak of a non-spontaneous one? Because a large minority of human beings are mentally equipped to take part in the advance of physical science, and all receive the crude and visible benefits thereof. Only an insignificant minority, however, are inherently able to lead man through the greater involvements of mental science, and the benefits derived therefrom, while longer lasting, are more subtle and less apparent. Furthermore, since such an orientation would lead to the development of a benevolent dictatorship of the mentally best, virtually a higher subdivision of man, it would be resented and could not be stable without the application of a force which would depress the rest of mankind to brute level. Such a development is repugnant to us and must be avoided. What then is the solution? The solution is the Selden Plan. Conditions have been so arranged and so maintained that in a millennium from its beginnings, 600 years from now, a second galactic empire will have been established, in which mankind will be ready for the leadership of mental science. In that same interval, the second foundation in its development will have brought forth a group of psychologists ready to assume leadership. Or, as I have myself often thought, the first foundation supplies the physical framework of a single political unit, and the second foundation supplies the mental framework of a ready-made ruling class. I see. Fairly adequate. Do you think that any second empire, even if formed in the time set by Selden, would do as a fulfillment of his plan? No, Speaker, I do not. There are several possible second empires that may be formed in the period of time stretching from 900 to 1700 years after the inception of the plan. But only one of these is the second empire. And in view of all this, why is it necessary that the existence of the second foundation be hidden, above all, from the first foundation? The student probed for a hidden meaning to the question and failed to find it. He was troubled in his answer. For the same reason that the details of the plan as a whole must be hidden from mankind in general, the laws of psychohistory are statistical in nature and are rendered invalid if the actions of individual men are not random in nature. If a sizable group of human beings learned of key details of the plan, their actions would be governed by that knowledge and would no longer be random in the meaning of the axioms of psychohistory. In other words, they would no longer be perfectly predictable. Your pardon, Speaker, but I feel that the answer is not satisfactory. It is well that you do. Your answer is quite incomplete. It is the second foundation itself which must be hidden, not simply the plan. The second empire is not yet formed. We have still a society which would resent a ruling class of psychologists, and which would fear its development and fight against it. Do you understand that? Yes, Speaker, I do. The point has never been stressed, don't minimize. It has never been made in the classroom, though you should be capable of deducing it yourself. This and many other points we will make now and in the near future during your apprenticeship. You will see me again in a week. By that time, I would like to have comments from you as to a certain problem which I now set before you. I don't want complete and rigorous mathematical treatment. That would take a year for an expert, and not a week for you. But I do want an indication as to trends and directions. You have here a fork in the plan at a period in time of about half a century ago. The necessary details are included. You will note that the path followed by the assumed reality diverges from all the plotted predictions, its probability being under 1%. You will estimate for how long the divergence may continue before it becomes uncorrectable. Estimate also the probable end if uncorrected, and a reasonable method of correction. The student flipped the viewer at random and looked stonily at the passages presented on the tiny built-in screen. He said, "Why this particular problem, Speaker? It obviously has significance other than purely academic." "Thank you, my boy. You are as quick as I had expected. The problem is not supposititious. Nearly half a century ago, the mule burst into galactic history, and for 10 years was the largest single fact in the universe. He was unprovided for, uncalculated for. He bent the plan seriously, but not fatally. To stop him before he did become fatal, however, we were forced to take active part against him. We revealed our existence, and infinitely worse, a portion of our power. The First Foundation has learned of us, and their actions are now predicated on that knowledge. Observe in the problem presented, here and here. Naturally, you will not speak of this to anyone." There was an appalled pause as realization seeped into the student. He said, "Then the Selden plan has failed." "Not yet. It merely may have failed. The probabilities of success are still 21.4% as of the last assessment." Chapter 9. The Conspirators. For Dr. Darrell and Peleus Anthor, the evenings passed in friendly intercourse, the days in pleasant unimportance.